Welcome to Ask Dr. Seibel, your best resource for answers to all the questions you may have about your menopause experience. Dr. Maish Seibel is an international leader on women's health and menopause and is committed to supporting women in navigating the change for a healthy, vibrant life. He's editor of My Menopause magazine in the Apple newsstand and on Google Play, and founder of Menopause Breakthrough, a five-week online course that helps women create their own personal menopause breakthrough action plan. He's former director of Harvard Medical School's Beth Israel Hospital Division of Reproductive Medicine, director of the University of Massachusetts Medical School's Complicated Menopause Program, and author of The Estrogen Window, due out from Rudell Press, April of 2016. Each month, Dr. Seibel will answer questions submitted by his community, real questions from women and the men who love them about the challenges and the blessings of menopause. Welcome, Dr. Seibel.
Hi, Sherry, and it's so great to be here. And I also want to say thank you all for joining us this evening, and it's a pleasure. I know you're all busy, and I'm so happy that you're taking time to come here, and I want to make this really valuable for you. And often what we do when we have these calls is that we will have the calls written in ahead of time, and we do have some questions that have been written in, but tonight we wanted to do something a little bit different, and we wanted to be able to have the opportunity to hear directly from you. So in a moment, we're going to open it up to questions, and if you have things that you would like to ask, I'd be happy to address them. And the way you would do that is if you're on the webcast, you're going to have to type it in into the chat so we'll know that you're there. So just type it in. And if you're on your phone, you can press star 2, and then we will unmute you, and then you'll be able to ask your questions. And we keep it on mute, and the reason for that is there's a lot of people who have a lot of background noise and so forth. And we are recording the call, and we do that so that we can put these up so that people who can't get here on time this evening, it doesn't work out for them, or things don't happen to make them available, we can have it so that they can come back at a later date. So it's mostly to keep the sound recording from background sounds and so forth. And I know that it's a great opportunity for you. If you have some things you want to ask, it's a great opportunity to do that, because as you know, when you go to the doctor, there's often such little time to get your questions asked that it often doesn't happen, or sometimes it can be embarrassing or uncomfortable, and you may not even want to do it at that setting. So at this time, what I'm going to do is to go ahead and ask you, if you have some questions that you'd like to do, go ahead and dial on your phone star 2, and if you are on the webcast, just type it into the chat, and we will start in and answer your questions.
Wow, Dr. Maish, we already had questions coming in before you even asked for them. I have two or three questions that are in from the question box. So while we're waiting for people to raise their hands, and you can do that on the screen, you'll see the little raise hand button or the star 2. Let's start with a question from Victoria. And she says, "Dear Dr. Seibel, I'm 48 years old and experiencing a lot of tension in the muscles of my shoulder and neck and dizziness. Could these symptoms be attributed to perimenopause?"
Well, that's a very good question. And, of course, perimenopause is that window of time that leads up to menopause, just like the perimeter is the area around. Perimenopause, of course, is that window around menopause. And it's most intense, right, in the couple of years leading up to menopause and in the year or two after. But it can start as much as 10 years before. So, you know, muscle tension and those kinds of feelings certainly have a lot to do with sometimes physical things, but oftentimes stress things. So one of the questions you have to ask is you have to be in touch with if you're doing anything different in terms of your neck or shoulder, something that's physical. But also, if you're feeling a lot of tension, it's certainly one place that it could show up. And she asked about the stress in her neck, and what else?
The stress in her neck and shoulders and dizziness.
And dizziness. So one of the things that can also happen in the perimenopause period is sometimes there is a lot of palpitations of the chest. There's a lot of fluttering, and that can sometimes be associated with dizziness. So, you know, dizziness is one of the things that you have to, first of all, make sure that it isn't something else. It reflects an irregular heartbeat unrelated to menopause or other medical symptoms. So I would say that while dizziness is a common symptom of menopause or perimenopause, it's one of those things that you have to make sure isn't due to something else, because some people will also have low blood sugars. They will be in that window of time, it can affect their glucose levels. So it's something you want to investigate, but it's highly likely that it is related to perimenopause. But without more information, I can't be specific for you. But it is a symptom associated with this window of life.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. I'm going to go to the lines. Judith has written in a question, but I believe she's also on the line. So, Judith, if you're there, I'm going to unmute you. And if you would like to ask Dr. Mace your question live, that would be awesome.
Sure. Hi there.
Hi.
Hi.
So, I actually have type 1 diabetes. It used to be called juvenile. I understand it's not called juvenile anymore, but I was diagnosed, oh goodness, about 48 years ago, so a long time.
Mm-hmm.
I am really healthy. I was told by an endocrinologist not to take hormonal replacement therapy, and I just wanted to know what your opinion was about that.
Well, I have to begin by saying that it all depends on the individual, so understand that when I speak to that point, I can only speak in generalizations.
Yeah.
But the reason that I feel that it's something that you should explore still a little bit further is as follows. And this is all part of a lot of what's coming out in the new book I have, The Estrogen Window, that's coming out in April from Rodale, where it talks about how much misunderstanding, I call it misunderstanding, has been going on with estrogen since 2002, when it was thought to increase the risk of heart disease. So here's what's important for you to know, and that is that at the current time in history, at this point in time, the use of estrogen associated with heart disease, if estrogen gets started right at the time of menopause, right about the time you get started, or within a short window after it, estrogen actually lowers the risk of heart attack and heart disease. And the reason it does that is because the estrogen dilates the blood vessels, keeps more blood flow into the heart, and it does that for the brain as well. So it actually may not be the case that you have to stay away from it, and I would certainly consider talking with at least another doctor and getting another opinion. Now, one of the things that matters a lot is if you have your uterus or you don't. And the reason it matters is because women who have their uterus, if they take only estrogen, are at some increased risk of uterine cancer. But if they add to it progesterone or a substance like progesterone, that risk is pretty much eliminated. The problem is that back in 2002, when this study came out that caused all the concern, the progestin, which is a synthetic progesterone that was used, was called Provera, or medroxyprogesterone. And that particular one is the most anti-estrogen one on the market. But natural progesterone or bioidentical progesterone wasn't available then as a pill. It was only available as a shot, so they didn't have it to use. And that medroxyprogesterone can increase the risk of heart attack, and that's where it got confusing a little bit for women who have their uterus. Women who don't have a uterus don't need the progestin or progesterone at all. So if you talk to someone and you use estrogen, in general, you want to try and use more of a bioidentical progesterone with it and not Provera. And also there are other synthetic ones which have been used safely. One of them is called norethindrone. It's also present in some birth control pills. But to answer your question succinctly, it's not unreasonable for you to consider taking estrogen if you started at the time of menopause or within a short window after that. And it's at least worthwhile looking at your personal history and talking with someone else and get a second opinion.
Okay, thank you.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. So, Dr. Mache, the questions are just pouring in here, mostly in the Q&A box. So thank you, everybody, for joining us on the webcast. The next question is from Susan, and she says she's had a total hysterectomy last year, and the surgeon told her it would be very likely for her to gain at least 20 pounds. And she says she's lost 25 pounds, which is not a bad thing. However, she's wondering if there's any difference between keeping your own ovaries or having them removed concerning weight gain or loss.
Well, Susan, you've asked several questions, and they're all very important. So first of all, let me talk to you about them in the order that you mentioned them. The first one has to do with, you know, you take out your uterus and you're going to lose 20 pounds. Well, first of all, you're going to gain 20 pounds. If your uterus was taken out for something that was like fibroids or something that was really heavy, you know, with a lot of weight, and some women lose 20 pounds from their surgery just from taking them out. But the question is, will taking out your uterus cause you to gain weight? Well, that's really a bit of a fallacy. It is harder to maintain weight after menopause. That's true, and it's a function of aging. And every decade, we metabolize what we eat about 3% slower. So if you eat the same amount, you'll gain about 3% per decade if you eat exactly the same amount. So you've got to adjust your diet. And here's where exercise is really important, and here's where food choices are really important. Estrogen, in fact, does help to maintain weight. In other words, estrogen doesn't cause weight loss. Estrogen doesn't cause weight gain. It actually contributes to weight loss. And what happens is estrogen prevents a lot of the fat in our body from migrating over to the belly, which is what happens. A lot of women will start to get a lot of that jelly belly, as they call it, or menopot. But that doesn't have to happen. It's not inevitable, and estrogen helps to control it. So I think that another part of your question, you asked if it helps to keep your ovaries in. And one thing I want to explain to you is that when you have the hysterectomy done, what happens is, as a result of all the clamping and things that happen to the blood vessels, to the uterus, to take the uterus out, what happens is it actually narrows or constricts the arteries that go to the ovaries. So what ends up happening is, just like if you have a constriction or a narrowing of the blood vessels in your heart, you would have a heart attack. Well, it's not exactly a common phrase, but if you have a hysterectomy, it takes the blood flow and kind of turns it off temporarily and causes it to constrict, and you have like an ovary attack. And what happens is that part of the ovarian function is lost. So just because you have a hysterectomy and leave your ovaries in, it will speed up menopause by about 5 years, because the blood flow and the infarction, or the loss of blood flow to the ovaries, causes loss of ovarian tissue. So leaving it in is good, assuming that there's no medical reason to have taken it out. And keeping it in will control weight longer. But just because your ovaries are in doesn't mean you can't go into menopause a little bit earlier. That might happen. So if you don't have a uterus and you don't have periods and you don't have a way to know, be mindful of symptoms like warmth or hot flashes or difficulties in other areas that are associated with menopause, because you may be going into menopause sooner than you think, and you may want to have a blood test done for FSH, follicle stimulating hormone, which is a simple blood test which will tell if your ovaries are working at their peak or not. And if they're not, then you can talk with your doctor or healthcare provider about estrogen at that time if it's something you want to take and if it works for your personal benefits and risks. But estrogen and weight are associated with each other, and it makes it easier to control if you have estrogen.
Very good. very great information. We have several people, actually. Kay and Dinah are asking questions about adrenals and thyroid. Kay, for instance, says she has Hashimoto's, adrenal problems, chronic fatigue. She's also a breast cancer survivor that's now in menopause. She feels like she needs bioidentical hormones to be balanced and wants to know what your opinion is.
Well, the issue with breast cancer, you have a number of things going on. And a lot of it depends on really what the symptoms are and what it is that you need the estrogen for, what you need hormones on for. You realize that bioidentical estrogens, this is a whole discussion that I talk about in my book, The Estrogen Window, but bioidentical estrogens are, that's not a medical term, it's a marketing term. It doesn't have anything to do with natural. What bioidentical means, though, or has come to mean, is that the hormones that you get are the same chemical structure as the ones that your body would normally make. And what ends up happening is you can get bioidentical hormones in one of two ways. You can either get them from a compounding pharmacy, and they will take a certain amount of the estrogen or progesterone, but the bioidentical hormone, put it into some kind of a compounded substance that will allow you to rub it on or swallow it or however way it's given, and they will mix it up in that, or you can get it from a traditional chain drugstore that is FDA regulated. Now, I have no axe to grind with the compounding pharmacies. There are many, and they do a great job. But I will tell you, I just came back from the annual meeting of the North American Menopause Society, and in that, they talked about a survey, and what they found is that many people don't realize that compounding pharmacies don't have any FDA approval. The medicines have only been regulated since 2013 at all. They've only been begun to be regulated in any way. So what you get may or may not be what the doctor orders. I want to explain this. It's an important thing because there was a study done just a couple of years ago in which they went to a dozen different pharmacies, compounding pharmacies, and they took the same prescription, gave it to 12 places, and then they got the hormones, and then they sent it to a chemical laboratory that does hormone analysis. And what they found is almost universally that the women who got the estrogen that they got from the compounded pharmacies was actually as much as 50 to 80% higher than what was in the prescription. And the progesterone that they got was about 50% less. And what's starting to happen now is that women who have a uterus and who have to have both estrogen and progesterone are starting to show up, a slow but steady trickle of women are starting to show up with uterine cancer because they're getting more estrogen than they thought and they're getting less progesterone than they thought. And this is causing a real problem. So if you're on one that comes from a compounding pharmacy, you really need to have your healthcare provider check your uterine lining and make sure that there's no buildup of the lining towards precancer and then cancer. It doesn't happen in a day. It takes about 5 to 10 years for this transformation to take place. But this is really important to be aware of. In terms of being balanced or not, there's a lot of balance that goes on between the thyroid. Hashimoto's can be very challenging, and estrogen and thyroid are interwoven in terms of if you take one, it alters the other. The other part of the equation is that it depends on what the symptoms are. Like there are now some prescription non-estrogens available for things like vaginal dryness or for hot flashes. The newer medication is called Osfina, which is a medication, ospemifene. It's a non-estrogen for vaginal dryness, and another one called Brisdale, which is for hot flashes. There are a number of new medications out there. Depending on your situation and how far out you are from your breast cancer, it's hard to find a doctor who's comfortable giving estrogen to women who have breast cancer. And many do fine without it particularly if they use these alternatives to estrogen, these prescription non-estrogens. And, of course, there are other things like exercise and diet, nutrition, and so forth. I wish I could be more specific, but I don't have quite enough information to address it. You've asked some really important questions, but these are subtle responses that I would need to know more, but I hope that's helped you.
Wow, and what I heard is just how intertwined everything is, and that makes it even more complex.
Mm. Yes, it is.
Yeah, so our next question, we have, again, two or three people writing in about weight loss. Nancy says she can't lose weight as easy as she used to. Kandarpa says she can't lose weight no matter what she does. She's been in menopause for 2 years and is 52 years old.
Mm-hmm. Well, as I mentioned earlier, weight loss is one of the most troublesome symptoms of menopause, and it does occur for many women that weight is gained at this time. But a lot of it has to do with, some of it has to do with estrogen, some of it has to do with slowing down of metabolism. It's also a time when we just talked about Hashimoto's disease, which is a form of low thyroid, but when thyroid disease shows up, about 5% of women have thyroid disease, so occasionally women will have low thyroid that factors into this or other problems. But the good news is that it really requires discipline and regimen in terms of the diet and exercise. So what happens, and I didn't mention it when we were talking earlier about weight control, the women who do exercise and are taking estrogen actually get more muscle buildup when they do their exercises and build up. And the more muscle you have, the more calories you burn, because muscles burn about 6 calories per pound, and fat burns about 2. So the more muscle you have, the more calories you're going to burn if you're just sitting there. So it is a challenge. It requires really looking at the foods you eat. It requires also looking at your sleep, because a lot of times in menopause, sleep gets disturbed, and women who have women and men who get disturbed sleep, the hormones that regulate appetite get off a bit. So what happens is leptin, the hormone that lets you, there's leptin that tells you when you're full, and when you have poor sleep, the leptin isn't at the same level, so you eat more, and then you also have another hormone called ghrelin, G-H-R-E-L-I-N, which is stimulated and makes you feel that you're actually more hungry. And so you have this two things going on that are fighting you if you're not sleeping well. So that's why the sleep part of weight control is very important. As a matter of fact, people who don't sleep well really have a particularly tough time dieting. So it's very important to factor that in. But it's a challenge, but as I said, the main things are really the basic things. The food that you eat, the exercise that you do, the regimen to keep doing it, controlling your sleep. Of course, stress and emotions play a role. Estrogen can help to lower it, making sure that there's not a thyroid issue or other factors. And it just takes discipline in going after it. It is a challenge. I mean, I have a whole webinar on weight control, and it's very, very challenging for a lot of women, but it's something that you can overcome. It just takes discipline in keeping after it.
Yeah, I can definitely ditto everyone's questions on that. Just a reminder, if you are on the call live and you would like to ask your question live to Dr. Seibel, you can hit *2 on your phone, or you can click on the little button that says raise your hand on the web call. So I'm going to take our next question is coming in from Dorothy, and she says she's 53 years old. She hasn't had a period for 6 months. She has, unfortunately, had a lot of hot flashes and other symptoms. Is it true that once you've not had your period for a year, you enter a post-menopause stage?
Well, the definition of menopause is 1 year after your last menstrual period, assuming it's natural menopause. So you are at that point in time in postmenopause, 1 year after your last period. That's true. And in terms of symptoms, symptoms are most intense for most women in approximately the 2, at most 3 years leading up to menopause and in the 1 year after. So in that kind of bell-shaped curve there, it gets more intense and more intense, and then after menopause, it stays somewhat intense but begins to trickle down. And then for most women, 1 to 2 out, the symptoms are much less. So it's not going to get worse and worse and worse. It's going to be at a peak point, and then in general, it's going to get better and better and better. Now, the one exception to that rule is vaginal dryness, and what they call vulvovaginal atrophy, or the new term is genitourinary syndrome of menopause, which is a lot of big words that mean the tissues of the vagina get drier, thinner, and the vagina can actually even shorten or narrow. That can happen. Doesn't happen to everyone. It happens to about 50% of women. And that doesn't really show up a lot until about 3 years after menopause. And then it can continue, particularly if the woman isn't sexually active or if she's not on estrogen. So the point of the story is most of the symptoms by 3 years after are getting better, are beginning to go away, but that one begins to show up and starts to get worse potentially, and so that's the one to keep and be mindful of. A lot of women think because it happens so much after menopause that it's not associated with it. It turns out there's 64 million women in menopause. 32 million of them have this condition, and only 15% actually talk to their doctor about it at all, ever, either because they're embarrassed or they think their doctor's embarrassed or because they think that it's not associated with menopause. And only 7%, that's 0.7%, get treatment for it. And this is something for which it can make a big difference in your intimacy and your relationships and how you feel about yourself and so many other things. So if that is an issue, be sure and tell your healthcare provider, because there's lots of treatments for that.
Thank you for that. I have a next question that coming in from someone but didn't put their name, so we'll call them anonymous.
All right.
About sleep patterns. And she says that her sleep patterns are really getting affected by menopause. She doesn't get hot flashes, but she has constant anxiety and panic attacks. What would be your insight around that?
Well, a lot has to do with if you had anxiety and panic attacks before menopause or not. What happens is that as the transition towards menopause happens and in the immediate window after it, the most common kinds of emotional things that happen, of course, there's the foggy, the brain fog, and there's the mood swings, and kind of a PMS a bit. And those are common things that for a lot of women, they're a nuisance, but they're not disruptive to them. And then people who have depression and anxiety, particularly if they had postpartum depression or if they had a clinical depression earlier in life or anxiety and depression earlier, these things tend to become more pronounced at the time of menopause. And a lot of times when I see women who are in their window of time around menopause and they have an underlying emotional or psychiatric condition, what ends up happening is all their treatments and medicines that were working suddenly don't work so well. And then when you treat them for their menopausal symptoms, many times these symptoms get back under control. So if the condition was there before and it's coming back with a vengeance, then treating your symptoms of menopause is going to be helping it a lot. In addition, if the symptoms are just starting and this is a new thing for you, then it's important to make sure what else is going on in your life at the same time, how much the sleep is being affected, and that can, of course, make people anxious. If you get chronically sleep-deprived, no one's going to be very calm if you're, you know, exhausted all the time. And this has a big impact. So often treating the symptoms of menopause will help anxiety, which is one of the most common symptoms. And sleep, as I mentioned earlier, is also a very common problem. So all of these things respond well to the treatment of the symptoms of menopause. But there, if sleep is the main issue, there's things that can be done for sleep. There's cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, which is totally a learned kind of a behavioral response to things that can, without any medicine, there's been good results with that. And then there are a variety of medications. And then there's sleep hygiene that you can do. And those are things like don't watch television late at night, stay away from the late night news with all those killings and all the bad things that happen. Turn your computer off a couple of hours before you go to bed. Take a nice relaxing bath. Get some lavender candles and some nice scents in there and make it feel good and make it a relaxing time. Put on some great music. You know, have room darkening shades. Keep your room a little bit cool. There's a lot of things that you can do to really make sleep better. But treating the symptoms of menopause will go a long way to helping as well.
Well, thank you for that. So we have a caller that's raised their hand, would like to ask a question live. It's someone from Westchester, New York, on a cell phone. I don't have your name. So if that's you, go ahead and ask Dr. Mace your question.
Good evening, Dr. Mace.
Hi.
What's your name?
Sandy.
Hi, Sandy.
So I don't know what phase of menopause I'm in, and I have, you know, small spotted discharge on a daily basis and have had that for about 5 months. But the concern I have is that no matter how many times I will take a shower or, take a shower and wash myself, I smell a little bit of an odor, that an unpleasant odor that I can't seem to rid, like halfway through the day.
Mm-hmm. Does it have a fishy smell at all?
Yeah, it's a little pungent. So, mm-hmm. I've done something where I will drink lots of water, which I do all the time anyway, and I stay away from kind of foods that I think that might ignite that type of odor. And it doesn't seem to go away. Comes up about, I don't know, halfway during the day.
Well, let me ask you this, a couple of questions. First of all, how old are you now?
52.
And how long since you were having regular periods?
I'm not really having regular periods. I think I'm in what they call perimenopause. So I'm having spotted discharge almost
mm-hmm.
on a regular basis.
But how long ago was it you were having regular periods?
About 9 months ago.
Mm-hmm. So the thing is this. If you have ongoing spotting, there's two points to your question, really. There's number one, you have some bleeding that's staining, that's coming kind of willy-nilly, it seems like, but it doesn't go away. And the second part is you have a discharge with some type of an odor, which for you is not normal. So
right.
The thing that you want to do at this point in time, it's always a good idea at this point to be checked. And the reason is because most of the time what you're describing is all pretty normal. But a couple of things can be going on. There can be other causes of bleeding besides the perimenopause or the symptoms related to this time of life. And you want to make sure that there's no abnormalities of the tissues either in the vagina or in the uterus up above. So you want to make sure, and so whenever there's staining, it's worth it to get it checked at least once so that you know what's going on. Now, discharges are often accompanying with menopause, and what ends up happening as estrogen gets lower, the estrogen changes the pH, the amount of acidity in the vagina. And it's kind of like in your normally the vaginal area is going to have a certain balance of good and bad bacteria. And they're in a certain balance. And then what ends up happening as menopause comes closer, the acidity goes from quite acid to much more alkaline. And when that happens, the, quote, good bacteria get outnumbered, because it's like in your pool when the algae comes or something, when you have to keep changing the pH of a pool. When it's not in balance, it is not in its pristine shape. So what happens is different bacteria come in, and so there's a condition called atrophic vaginitis, which is what it's called. But that's very common, and a lot of times that vaginal discharge can be all part, the stainy kind of thing that you have, the odor, everything can be associated with that. So the thing is that when you go to see your healthcare provider, they can do something called, first of all, they can just look and see what's going on. If there's a problem, there could be a little polyp, there could be lots of things. But second of all, they can do something called a wet prep. And what that is they take a slide and they take a little sample swab of the discharge and put it on that slide, and then they put different solutions in it, look at it under a microscope, and they can make a diagnosis for you. And if they don't see anything, they can do a culture to make sure there's not some other kind of infection. So it's worth it for you at this point to be seen, and then if it comes back, then you kind of know what's going on. But as it is, even though it's most likely nothing bad, you have to make sure that's the case. And so that's what I would do. And just go in, get it checked, and then after that you'll kind of know. Because the treatment will vary depending on what the cause is. And that's why it's hard to give you a solution, because it's quite a different approach if it's A, B, or C.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome. So our next question is from CG. It's another question on the webcast. And she says that she's taking an estrogen pill in a synthetic form, and it's mm-hmm. called Injuvia, and mm-hmm. she's wondering if it could possibly damage the liver.
Well, because it's a synthetic estrogen, or I'm not sure, just because it's synthetic, or if there's something about that particular one, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not sure. She says she tried bioidentical and it didn't work for her.
Mm-hmm.
She does take progesterone.
Well, if she got that, you know, if it's a FDA-approved estrogen, then the estrogen is there is if people have an underlying, if it's an oral medication and it's taken, it's an estrogen, it's going to be concentrated in the liver. And if people have an underlying liver condition, then it's certainly possible that it can cause a problem. But if that's not the case, it shouldn't be particularly harmful to the liver per se. I'm interested to, you know, I'm curious to wonder why there's concern about her liver specifically. I don't know why that thought is coming to her. Like, I'm wondering if there may be some other problem that's going on, and it's because of this medicine's being taken that there's a worry about that. So I'm curious about that.
But, CG, if you're still there, yeah, maybe you can clarify that question, and maybe we can get back to that.
Yeah.
Let's go to Judy. Judy is, first of all, wants to thank you for doing these sessions. She really appreciates it. And
pleasure.
Her question is, what is the oldest age a woman can get pregnant without medical intervention? She's 48. She's been on oral hormonal contraception for 17 to 18 years. She'd like to get off of it, but she's afraid she might get pregnant. So she's obviously not totally in menopause now.
Well, she doesn't know.
That's true, I guess. So she doesn't know if she's on menopause or perimenopause yet. There you go, since she's on the pill. She doesn't want to take any chances on getting pregnant at her age. Do you have any guidance?
Well, when you come off of, you know, this is always the challenge. I mean, every year I have one or so what I call oops babies, where the person, person who thinks they don't have to worry about it anymore. It comes in and their period stops and they think they're in menopause, and what they are is they're in mama pause because they are pregnant. And the thing is like Yogi Berra said, it ain't over till it's over. So it's good that you're thinking about this. Now, realize that a lot of women do go into menopause at 48. It's totally possible that you could be in menopause, but if you're on the pill, you won't know. So the best thing to do is to realize your fertility is going to be relatively lower at 48, but not zero. We don't know how much because you've been on the pill a long time and we have no real relative understanding of what your cycles are like. We don't know how you the regularity you would have, the likelihood of having an ovulation, or the likelihood that ovulation would result in a pregnancy. The chances are under 5%, that's for sure, maybe under 3%, but they aren't zero until you go through menopause. So if you are comfortable with it, then the thing to do is to go on something like using condoms or barrier contraceptive like a diaphragm. Diaphragms work really, really very well, and it's particularly at this time in life, the good thing about them is that there's no side effects unless you're allergic to the latex or something. There's no side effect from the diaphragm. That's the good news. If you're worried about it and you want to come off the pill and you want to be certain, then you have to get into some other form of contraceptive. One thing that some women will do at this point in life is they'll go on an IUD. So that doesn't affect their periods, but, you know, they do have a foreign body inside of them. If you have only one partner and you have an IUD, the risk of a problem or an infection is very, very, very low. If people have more than one partner, with each partner, the risk of infection goes up because the string of the IUD hangs out a little bit, and if there's any infection, it can kind of swim up the string and find a direct route into the uterus. So it's wise until you stop having periods to use precautions and not just assume, nothing will happen, because I can tell you it can. But the likelihood is about maybe 3%, and the simplest is to use barrier contraceptive like condoms or diaphragm, and if not, an IUD. And that's basically the choices that are out there that are readily available to everyone. So I hope that helps you, but it's good to be cautious. The other thing you can do is if you just want to come off the pill or you just want to know where you are, you can take like a pill holiday. You can go off the pill and use something as a contraceptive, another one, for just like 3 months and just see if you start having periods again, 3-4 months, and then you can always go back on it. That's another possibility too. But that's pretty much what people do, the majority.
Well, great ideas. So Melanie has a question about extreme hot flashes and night sweats. She wants to know, is there anything she can take? She's had a TIA, which you could probably tell us what that is, and she has high blood pressure.
Mm-hmm. Well, a TIA is a transient ischemic attack. It's kind of like a mini stroke. And so what she's saying indirectly is that she is not a good candidate for estrogen, which would be the, you know, the first line of choice for hot flashes. The it gets a lot harder with situations like this because you really want to make sure that you're not putting yourself at risk for another or worse situation because of the, you know, the history of the TIA. So, you know, you have to start getting into what are some of the other options. Here's where you start off with lifestyle, and I'll just go through some of the things that can be very helpful in terms of lifestyle. And those are hydrate a lot. You know, you drink 8 to 10 glasses of water a day. You try to do exercise because it is very good in terms of lowering the heat. The other things that you can do is to use the cognitive behavioral therapy that I talked about in the a little while ago. That can be very helpful. Other kinds of over-the-counter kinds of things that are used are things, simple things like soy, can be effective for women. It's much more effective for women who have the mild to moderate hot flashes than really, really severe ones. And the other options that are available over the counter are, there are a whole range of them, black cohosh, iCool, flaxseed, estrogen. There are a number of them. The problem is that the things that are typically used, for instance, even the one that is the non-estrogen for hot flashes, the Brisdale, also has some mild risk of stroke. And so even that becomes something that becomes harder to take. And, of course, the high blood pressure is the other issue. So the other thing you can do is talk about if any of those particular choices for your medicines that you're taking, for if you're taking something for the hot for the blood pressure or for the TIAs, is to look at what you're taking and just do a search on that and see if any of those are contributing to the hot flashes, and see if there's other options that you might be able to take that would have less of that as a side effect, because that sometimes is an issue. But it gets really down to looking for the lifestyle kinds of things that are the most helpful, and also making sure that you're avoiding anything that's a trigger. Like for some women, caffeine is a trigger, hot spicy foods are a trigger, alcohol is a trigger. There are a lot of hot peppers, you know, those kinds of things. So you have to look for what's a trigger and avoid it. Find the lifestyle things that can be most effective for you, and try over-the-counter options that do help some women. We do have, in our menopause breakthrough program, we have a whole section on the hot flashes and alternatives and things like that. But it is a challenge because you don't want to compromise your overall health for the hot flashes, and yet the hot flashes can really be a whole issue in terms of the quality of life if they're really bad. So I know it's difficult for you, and I hope if you try some of these lifestyle things, they'll be helpful.
Awesome. We still have a couple questions here. I know we're getting close to the top of the hour, but I'll try to squeeze these in. Questions from Renee and Winnie are kind of related. The first one is from Renee, and she is experiencing some prolonged periods. And Winnie says that she went a year without a period, but she's now started having it again. So can you talk a little bit about our cycle and what we should be aware of?
Well, in the window, one of the most common symptoms of menopause is the irregularity of the cycles, of course, because what happens is hormones are paired together, and what happens, if you can remember back to puberty when you were first starting your cycles, they would come and they would kind of come and then they wouldn't come and then they would come again and then there'd be some staining at the oddest times and then there'd be nothing. And then finally it kind of got itself regulated and it went like that for about 35 years. And then the same thing happened, only backwards. That's kind of what happens in this perimenopause window of time. Sometimes the periods are at the right time, but they're lighter, sometimes they're heavier, and sometimes they get closer together, and then eventually they get further and further apart. Usually when you get within about 2 years of menopause, then the what happens is the cycles start to get about 60 days apart or more. So when you start to notice your cycles are getting 2 months apart or longer, you know that you're creeping up on the on the menopause, you're usually within about 2 years of it, 3 years at most. It's not like he gives you a date on a calendar, but it does give you an idea that in the horizon, the end of the cycle is coming. When you have bleeding that stopped for a year and then comes back, in a situation like that, it's good to talk to your healthcare provider because you want to make sure there's nothing causing that to happen that shouldn't be happening naturally. So normally what happens is if somebody were to come to me about that, I would probably do what's called an endometrial biopsy, which is a procedure where in the office a very thin little plastic catheter is placed. It's about 2 millimeters. It's very small. It goes in the uterus, and you take out, it basically scrapes out about a very few cells, but then they can be looked at under a microscope and just make sure there's nothing abnormal there. Also, sometimes they will do an ultrasound, and the ultrasound can be done to look at the lining of the uterus, but of course that's indirect. So if you see something, you see something is there, but you don't know what it is. Then you have to go in and check it. Other people will do a procedure called a hysteroscopy, and many times these are done in the office. There's a 3 millimeter little scope. It's very small, and it's a flexible little thing that goes into the opening of the uterus and basically looks inside, and then it can see if there's a polyp or buildup of the tissue or anything like that. So bottom line, if you've gone a year and you weren't having a period and period comes back, then it's important to go ahead and check it out, you know, because a little office procedure, and I'm sure that it's got you worried, and this is a way to eliminate that worry, and you'll be able to know exactly, probably it's not going to be anything, but because it can be, it's important to check it out. In terms of the heavier periods, that is something that is very common, and there, too, if they start to get to be really heavy, then, again, you have to check that out because heavy periods can be a normal situation of the buildup of the lining that's just normal and it's just heavier because it's not happening as often. And when you have a period that comes every 2 months, it's going to be twice as much shedding, so it's just heavier. But sometimes there can be, again, polyps, which are little fleshy buildups of the tissue. They're not cancer, but they do cause bleeding and other problems. Are other kinds of conditions that causes these heavy bleedings. So if it's something that keeps happening and you're having to increase the number of pads you wear and it's something that's, you know, all of a sudden you're really having to change pads often or you're soiling your clothing or something like that, then that should be checked also just to make sure that there's not a problem. Probably neither one's going to be a problem, but you can't tell. You have to always make sure you don't miss something, and both of those could be something worth looking into.
Thank you so much for that information. Some great information tonight. We're going to have to make that be our last question for this call. I know you have an opportunity that you'd like to share with everybody.
Yes, I do. I mentioned earlier in our call that we have a menopause breakthrough program that's a really amazingly great content that's available online. It basically, it's a blueprint to help women go through menopause, and it's online. You can use it from your telephone, you can use it from your iPad or your other kinds of devices, or you can look at it at your computer. And it has 5 steps that take you through this whole window of life. And it starts out by going in and allows you to know how you're going to change, and it goes through all the changes that can happen and how you're going to be different and what's going to change, what to expect, what's normal, what's not. And then in the second step is once you understand that, it goes through a lot of the emotional changes that happen, how your self-esteem change, how will you feel differently in terms of all of the relationships you have, the importance of friendships and so forth. And it goes through the emotional changes. The third goes into all of the lifestyle things that you can do to improve the quality of your life in just by your behavior. And no matter whether you go on medicine or you don't go on medicine, there's things that can be done at this time of life that will reduce your symptoms and improve the quality of your care. So And then the fourth part is all about, okay, now you have all that information. What if you need hormones or not? And what are the options for hormones? Which ones? How much? How long? And if you don't want to take hormones, then what are the other alternatives to that? Prescription, non-prescription, and over-the-counter, and so forth. So there's a whole host of information in there, and a lot of that comes out of my new book, The Estrogen Window, which I've really been researching this for the last couple of years and have taken all the data on estrogen and spelled it out so that you can understand it. And finally, now that you have all that information, the final part is thriving in this window of life, all the things that can improve your sex life, if you have issues with sensitive bladder, if you're having issues to do with mindfulness or mindset, and all of the brain fog, all of that stuff, and even spirituality and how it ties in. And so my intention is just to offer it to you this evening, and to honor the fact that you've spent your time here. And what we're going to do is, if you're interested in finding out about it or learning about it, you can go to menopausebreakthroughlive.com, menopausebreakthroughlive.com. And what we're offering tonight, if you're interested, and this will only be good for tonight, is that the program generally sells for $497, but if you are interested and you act tonight, you can get it for $247. So we're giving a 50% discount as a thank you for coming and spending time this evening. And the format is, there's videos, there's audios, there are printouts that you can take, there's questions to ask your doctor, there's the tests and immunizations, all the things you need. There's a whole host of every part of this transition that's available. So if you're interested, you can go, again, as I mentioned, to menopausebreakthroughlive.com, and you can check that out. And I think, is there a code or something they would have to use? Sherry?
Nope. When they go to that page, they'll automatically get the discount, and through midnight tonight.
Okay.
Midnight Pacific, I should say.
Midnight Pacific, yeah. So, in any event, I want to thank you all for taking time out from your busy lives. We have calls every month. They're usually the third Thursday of the month. Every month we have them so that people can mail in their questions ahead of time at askdrseibel.com. That's askdrseibel.com. And if you go there, you can always put your questions in, and on the next call, we will answer them. But sometimes we like to do live questions, because I know that a lot of times it's so hard to say what you want to say in the context of typing out a quick thing, and I realized that. So I wanted to have the opportunity to have you join us, and I thank you for doing that. And if you are interested, you can go to menopausebreakthroughlive.com, and you can check out that program. And if you decide for any reason you don't like it, you can have it's a 30-day money-back guarantee, so it's not a huge risk. But what I will tell you is, it's a lot of great information that has helped a lot of women, and it could be something that you would find a great resource that you can come back to, and you can do it at night or in the morning. If you can do an email, you can do the program. It's very simple. It's made with people who are not very computer savvy in mind, so all you have to do is go on, you click on what you want to see, and it gives it to you, and it's in small bites, so you can get this topic or that topic and just really drill in on what you want to know. So I hope that will be helpful for you, and I want to thank you very much for spending time with me and with Sherry this evening.
Thank you, Dr. Mason. If I could just say, I've been through the course, and it is amazing. The information it contains is totally life-changing as a woman that is in menopause now, so I definitely would recommend you check that out. So thank you, Dr. Mache. And again, as you said, we'll be back here the third Thursday of next month, which will be November 19th. And thanks again for everybody for joining us. Bye.
Stay well.